You're listening to The Stack, first broadcast on the 7th of June 2014 on Monocle 24. Wiser, older, and most probably more powerful, it's time to look at a sector of the magazine market that is vast but largely ignored. Whether it's early retirement or reaching the top of the game, the over-50s reader is as diverse and dynamic as any other demographic. We take a look at the print offering for this age group, both the innovators and the traditionalists. This week we'll be looking at a more senior sector of magazine consumers. What do they expect to find on the newsstand, and are they getting what they want? We'll be asking if you can even call the over 50s a distinct demographic group when it comes to selling print. Which titles get the Stack gold medal for catering for our golden years? From rock and roll to womenswear, we analyse what, if anything, editors are doing to entice those of a certain age. Francine Lawrence, former editor of Country Living, will join me here in the studio. We'll also go to Sydney, where one classical musician decided to go to print.
These interviews are really a sort of dialogue and a discourse between musician to musician or artist to artist.
All that and plenty more besides coming up on today's edition of The Stack, Monocle 24's dedicated print industry review and analysis show with me, Tom Edwards. So it is time to welcome my guest today, an art director, editor, writer, photographer. I think it's fair to say a polymath. It's Francine Lawrence chuckling away in the background. Francine, welcome back to the programme. Great to have you with us as always. We're going to talk, I guess, today about magazines and what a stack of magazines that you have before you. But we're also going to touch upon the, I guess, sort of how you profile your audience and how you pitch to a particular demographic, in this case looking at it in terms of age, because it's often something of a vexed question. It challenges publishers. Sometimes they find it pretty easy to speak to a particular age group, other times pretty difficult. Do you think there are any, I don't know, hard and fast rules about how you speak to particular age groups, or is it a question of letting good editors speak to their audience in the way that they always seem to know how to do?
I think one of the problems we've got is that most magazines are run by people who are under 50, and we're talking about magazines for over 50s. So you get ad departments and marketing departments, and they're very good at speaking to people of their own age, speaking to their peers. And of course, as people get older, they move into, you know, senior management or often to their own companies. And so they're not speaking to their peers. So I think that, yes, a good editor knows their reader. When I'm asked to go into a magazine that maybe is in a bit of trouble or perhaps to launch a magazine, I always try to really inhabit the reader, if you like. And that means not just say looking up the research figures and saying, this is what they do, this is what they like. I really try to make a picture of that real person. So I try to find real people.
I think there is definitely some there's some scope for improvement perhaps in our domestic UK marketplace. But maybe let's delve into an impressive stack of magazines which you have brought
Thank
with you,
you
this week, Francine. Let's talk, maybe start with a bit of an old favourite or someone who you think really does know its market and does what it does very well, you know, in an unchanging way.
Yes. When I was thinking about this, you know, what magazine do I really love? I've got a little checklist, you know, a magazine that I want to take home and savour, you know, make myself a cup of coffee or a pot of really special Darjeeling tea and sit down with a magazine. And one that I absolutely love is The New Yorker. This magazine is a bit like a passport to New York. As soon as I pick it up and look at that wonderful typeface, which hasn't changed since, well, it probably has been tweaked since 1925, but essentially is still the same format, I feel as if I'm in New York. It's a wonderful magazine that hasn't changed. It has a bit of politics and it has wonderful long reads, and yet they're not boring. It's witty. I just feel as if I should be in the Algonquin, with, you know, sitting in Dorothy Parker's chair.
And I wonder, I mean, it's interesting, you mentioned the long-form journalism and some of our other aficionados who can't help but reference The New Yorker when we talk on The Stack. They do talk about that commitment to long-form journalism. Is that something that the older reader, the more senior reader, is happier with, do you think? Is there a danger that there's an impatience almost amongst younger readers? And this is fueled, of course, by, you know, the various digital sort of outposts that people are driven towards increasingly. Or do you think that, is there a reassuring number of younger readers too who will take refuge in The New Yorker because they can get the thousands of words that they actually do want and which are rather too scarce elsewhere?
I think definitely slightly older readers do prefer a longer read. And I, as an ex-art director, always used to get frustrated, you know, when an editor used to come in with a huge manuscript and say, you've got 6 pages to lay this out, which meant that the pictures came down to postage stamps. But in The New Yorker, somehow it satisfies that need that I think, yes, I think there are some younger people, definitely, who like a long read, but it's definitely for people over 40, say, I think they find the relentlessness of the younger aimed magazines that just don't have any decent stuff to read. It's a lot of fantastic images, but it's all kind of really in your face. And you sometimes think, hey, couldn't you pace this a bit better? Couldn't we have a long read in between some of these really pacey, great features? But
and what about the art direction with your sort of art director's hat on? That's interesting because New Yorker, as you said, has made a virtue of its unflinching commitment to doing what it's done and not changing. And in terms of the style, as you also said, it hasn't changed a great deal. Do you think that that sort of conservatism with a small C sits more comfortably with an older reader? Or do you think actually, say, the over 50 audience is quite happy for their favourite products, their favourite magazines to change their appearance? Do you think that maybe people are rather too cautious with how they approach that demographic?
I think with The New Yorker, you want it to be reassuringly the same. I think there are other magazines that we could look at that have long reads and feel, oh, you know, this is for older people, therefore let's be very serious and let's not have too many pictures. But I think with The New Yorker, it's a unique product, and I think it copes very well with the long read not being broken up by anything more than, say, the odd poem or cartoon.
A cartoon yes. About a dog out and about in Manhattan, of
exactly.
course.
Exactly. Fabulous cartoons and fantastic illustrations. Great photography, you know, sparingly used, but very good.
It's a very fine effect. Let's continue through your stack then. Is there something, any other titles you've picked out that perhaps take a very, I don't know, a radically different approach, but still deliver? Or maybe some that even miss the target? I don't know. Where should we head next?
Well, we have Saga magazine, which is incredibly popular here in the UK. And it definitely has the subject matter that is aimed at the over 50s. I just think that it's a disappointing, predictable kind of layout. It just could be so much more exciting. I think it stays on the side of safe. It has some very good features. I mean, we've got Debbie Harry. It's got the expected celebrity. It's got a good feature on hippies, what happened to them, which of course appeals to the baby boomer market. But in terms of layout, yes, the paper rather lets it down, but then that's economy, I guess. It just could be a little more exciting, I think.
And is that a design flaw fundamentally? Do you think editorially, because you mentioned a couple of ideas there that actually is quite engaging, you sort of want to dip in, is it fundamentally the design perhaps where it falls flat?
I think so. I think that it's not helped by the ads.
It's funny. That is one of the things that jumps out, just leafing through a few pages.
Yeah.
There's a lot of sort of fairly senior looking people,
you know,
with various products that you imagine would appeal to nobody and gardening suggestions.
I feel sorry for the editorial team who are doing their absolute best to produce a good magazine aimed targeted, you know, at their market, and the ad department who are trying to sell the ads, but obviously the ads that they can get are the very people that seem to want to wear very drab frocks or have a problem with
them.
It's such a shame because this should be an exciting magazine. It really should be.
Rather than appealing to the senior, short-sighted members of the community out there.
I mean, over 50s people, you know, they're hopping around the world, like I said, on, you know, long-haul backpacking holidays. They're going to Machu Picchu and doing all sorts of things, you know.
Now, we're going to talk a lot more about some other magazines and selections you've got in your stack today, Francine. I just wondered on the sort of overall point about how, I guess, the management, the publishers actually start to divide and conquer and work out who's going to chase what, which titles are going to appeal to which demographics. And there's some interesting examples. I was talking to Tyler a few weeks ago about Stern in Germany and how they have some very successful titles. Neon, for example, which is pitched more at sort of 20-somethings, unisex appeal, does very well, looks the part. And they've also made these forays now into sort of over 40s with their Viva title. And Tyler was, I think it's safe to say, skeptical about the merits of doing that. Do you think that sometimes age almost shouldn't really be a factor and that you can risk almost cutting off your nose to spite your face?
Absolutely. And I think that's probably, you know, where Saga has fallen down, because it's so known as a magazine for over 50s that as soon as you put that on your coffee table, everyone knows you're over 50. But I think the most successful magazines are the ones that don't advertise that fact. I call them Trojan horses. I think everybody thinks of themselves as 10 years younger than they really are. And so you definitely do not want to be sitting there on the tube with a magazine that says, I am over 40 or I am over 50. I remember that there was a magazine that came out in the States. I think it was Lear's magazine, which was a sort of silver hair kind of aimed magazine, and it should have been a raging success, but it wasn't. Who wants to admit that? Tyler's quite right, that if a magazine says it's for over 40s, then, you know, people over, you know, in their 40s are not going to read it.
That's the insights of Francine Lawrence. We'll be hearing more from her as we continue to delve into her stack of magazines this week, right after this. You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. Now, from the over 50s market to a sector that is altogether more niche. Let's go to Sydney for a musical interlude. World's Only magazine is the passion project of freelance musician Megan Clune. Having seen a gap in the market for a niche magazine that focuses on the careers of successful classical musicians, Megan launched a publication with uncompromising attention to both storytelling and visual narrative centred around music and the people who play it. Having just sent issue 4 to newsstands, Monocle's contributor Jack Phillips met Megan in a coffee shop in Sydney's Surrey Hills to flick through the pages.
I started World's Only shortly after finishing my undergraduate degree in music. I had a bit of a quarter-life crisis, I guess. I was really thinking about what I wanted to do. I was not really happy with the classical music world and my experience of it. I just wanted to try and find my own way of having a career in that field. I went on a trip to New York and I happened to go to the New York Art Book Fair at MoMA PS1 and I saw a bunch of magazines there and I was like, yeah, I could do that. So I came home and I decided I wanted to start a magazine. So I reached out to a lot of people that I thought were really inspiring, a lot of sort of heroes, I guess. How did they end up having these really interesting and varied careers? I got a really good response. People really loved talking about themselves. And we're kind of flattered that, you know, I had this appreciation for what they were doing.
Using a connection at the nearby events venue, Alaska Projects, in Sydney's city centre, Megan published issue 1 with a vibrant launch party and a small print run of just 100 copies, which to her delight, sold out rather quickly.
It's A5 in size, which is sort of a nod to that music scene past. And it's very simple in its layout, which is a real point of difference from a lot of music magazines as well. When you look at something like Rolling Stone, the layout is pretty loud and there's a lot of things going on and it doesn't necessarily showcase the content in the best way possible, or I think anyway. And so I wanted to make something that was really simple because it's only every 6 months, something that's quite lasting and collectible.
With increasing interest in the publication, issue 4 of World's Only hit selected newsstands 2 weeks ago. Having increased its production run with each issue, the magazine promises more than just great stories and offbeat interviewees.
For issue 4, I got illustrator Total Bore, who's also a musician, and it now turns out, a few months later, that he's playing in a band with Alistair Hill, who's our contributing editor, so it's come full circle. And we've also got some really beautiful photos by a good friend, Anastasia Nielsen. 6 interviews plus a photo shoot with Moon Holiday.
Interestingly, some of the people featured in the magazine have now become collaborators in Megan's other passion in life, playing music with her band Alaska Orchestra.
The people that I've interviewed in the early stages of the magazine I'm now working with again as a musician. Interviewed Glenn Branca in the first issue of World's Only, and now my group, Alaska Orchestra, are going to be recording some of his music later in the year, and the same with Christina Vansu. it is something that's a really important part of my life and has provided not just inspiration but a lot of work from it as well. As the magazine grows, I think it's really important that we sort of keep that as well. You know, I think it's going to stay pretty small. It grows each issue, but I think it's really important to keep that, you know, really honest and simple, you know, basis to it.
With so much care taken in the look and the feel of the magazine, as well as the importance placed on short print runs, getting the magazine into the hands of readers has become an important part of distinguishing the brand from other music titles.
We're stocked at the Serpentine Gallery in London, Art Metropole in Toronto, and the MCA, Museum of Contemporary Art store in Sydney. Earlier in the year, we were looking at distributing the magazine internationally, but because this is such a personal project, I felt a little bit nervous about letting go of the control over where it was going to be sold. So I decided that we were going to focus our sales with the online store and selected stockers, which stores that I'd either been to or I knew about and that I sort of trusted that they would display it in the right way and that their customers would also appreciate what Worlds Only has to offer as well. There's a lot of like blood, sweat and tears that goes into it.
The focus for the magazine has from its roots been about the user experience. At present, it has no advertising within its pages, so it draws all of its revenue from its cover price, a modest $15. So for that reason, Megan says, Worlds Only offers that little bit more to its fans.
So the magazine is printed in Australia, which is quite important to us as well, despite being a more expensive option to support the printing industry in Australia. Each magazine is hand-signed and numbered as well to provide the reader with a really unique experience. It's a collector's item and something that is to be really treasured and valued, the same way that we're like really treasuring this experience in talking to people and engaging. So yeah, it was really about finding a way to portray that in the physical object, which is definitely something that I have thought a lot about in its four issues as well. These interviews are really a sort of dialogue and a discourse between musician to musician or artist to artist.
That was Monocle contributor Jack Phillips meeting Megan Clune, the woman behind Worlds Only magazine in Sydney. You are listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and my special guest this week, Francine Lawrence, the multi-talented magazine aficionado that she is. And we are ploughing through a pretty weighty selection of magazines this week. And we're talking about, well, magazines maybe targeted at the sort of over 50s, that kind of marketplace. We've had, I guess already we've talked about a magazine doing that very well, because I guess it's been very confident in what it does. That's being The New Yorker. A magazine that maybe you were suggesting has found it rather more difficult, found it slightly more constraining, talking about Saga magazine here in the UK. Where should we go next? And tell us perhaps whether you feel this is a magazine, whichever you choose, that is doing a good job or maybe has some way still to go.
I think a magazine that is doing a really good job, although perhaps they wouldn't like to be advertised as a magazine that's for the over 50s, is Vanity Fair. You know, I was talking about Trojan Horses, and I do think that Vanity Fair does appeal to an older market, and it really is a magazine that satisfies. What's good about Vanity Fair is that it has, I always think that you should have surprises in magazines. Obviously, you've got to have the list of items that are going to appeal to your market, and in Vanity Fair's case, it's going to be celebrity, it's going to be controversy, a bit of politics, a bit of culture and so on, but it always has surprises. And this month they've got a feature on Kappa, the wonderful war photographer. So it also ticks that history box that older people like. Very important publishers listen to that. We do like history, us slightly older people. And it's a really great read.
Well, and there's something, essentially you talk about the fonts, the typeface and the general design. There's a certain understated, I guess you'd call it elegance. And I think that is something that resonates with, you know, particular demographics, people of good taste, of course, throughout the age bracket, but certainly the more refined reader can enjoy that. Do you think maybe some magazines perhaps aware of not wanting to be seen to sort of pander to, you know, a conventional view of, you know, what the more senior reader wants, are maybe a little reluctant about saying, rather unashamedly, well, this is about elegance, it is about a bit of style, and there's nothing wrong with that?
I think we've got to a point when you're appealing to an older market that, you know, we've tried everything. You know, this group of people are the baby boomers. We were brought up on Twen and Nova, you know, fantastic magazines that looked great. But we've seen all the other, you know, we've seen ID and all the other magazines that have really, I will admit, exciting and unusual layout. But, you know, when it comes down to it, it's really nice and reassuring to have a clearly laid out, beautifully classic magazine. And I think that's what Vanity Fair does.
Timeless qualities, perhaps. Let's talk a little bit about some of the new kids on the block, maybe some of those slightly more bolder, radical thinkers. And you have a copy, of course, of a particular magazine that always leaps out when, admittedly, a few of our guests do bring it along, and it's a friend of the programme as well. You have the Gentlewoman here. Mm. Now, tell us about this, because a lot of the fans think it has a unique character. Do you detect, when you look at something like Gentlewoman, do you sort of see the lineage with your knowledge of magazines? Do you see the lineage? Do you see the heritage? Do you see where some of the best aspects of it come from?
Well, you know, it's interesting because when you start looking at magazines for this particular market, they fall into different categories. You know, men seem to like specialist subjects. You know, they go for the fishing or the golf or the yachting magazines. And sadly, the magazines that are aimed specifically at women are pretty dull, you know, they're awful fashion for, you know, and everyone's obsessed by their weight or, you know, grey hair or whatever. And the Gentlewoman is unashamedly aimed at women. It is, I would say, aimed at women of all ages. But what's great about this particular issue, it's got Vivian Westwood on the cover. Just to talk about the design, which, I mean, the cover itself, you could say, was quite dull. They do it every issue the same way, you know, with a coloured background and a squared up picture in the centre. But you know what? That really stands out on the newsstand.
Well, it's funny, when we talked to Penny Martin from The Gentlewoman a few weeks ago on the stack, and we talked about that, their cover girl, their cover features. Mm. And it was interesting talking about how the confidence they had in allowing that image, and as you said, that simple character to speak for itself. Mm. But you do need a rather singular vision of somebody like that to run a title like that, to make it stick, because there's often too many sort of fair weather ideas blowing in and out that people want to try and chop and change. And a lot of people, publishers and editors alike, maybe wouldn't have the, I guess it's an underlying confidence to just stick with something simple and go with it with real conviction.
As you said, people allow ideas to blow in and blow out, and magazines become very, they're suffering from blandism. Everything is the same. Every magazine you pick up has, you know, the same mix of subjects. But The Gentlewoman, it doesn't compromise. It's just about women, for women. And I really like it. And it's got lots of fashion in it. And it's not silly fashion. It's the stories behind fashion. You know, we love fashion. Women love fashion. Nothing wrong with that. And some of the more general magazines that we've talked about today, you know, have news and politics. But, you know, this one is for women, and I love it. It's great.
And just on that, do you think that when you spot the new Gentlewoman on the newsstand, or it lands on your doormat, I don't know which one of those two options, do you read it and look at it and think, this is a reason to celebrate magazines? Or alternatively, do you say, oh, this is rather sad. This is increasingly, you know, in isolation. There are fewer and fewer magazines that are doing the kind of job that I think they should be doing. Is it an occasion for delight or a measure of despair, perhaps?
I feel increasingly optimistic. In fact, I was in the newsagent just a couple of minutes before I came in here, the newsagent in Chilton Street, who I'm sure is a friend of all of yours here, talking to him. And he said, you know, print is not dead. There are so many good magazines coming out in print. And I was so heartened to hear that, because 2 years ago, everyone was saying, oh, no, you know, it's all over. But it's not. And I do get that little flutter that I used to get when I used to wait for the last Thursday of every month for Nova to appear. I get it when I see the new copy of The Gentlewoman. I think, oh, what have they got now?
Wonderful stuff. I think we've got time for one last magazine. Well, should we select an august title, another name that everyone will know? Where should we head next?
I'm terribly torn now. I've got, in one hand, I've got Rolling Stone, because that is a magazine that has been going for years and years, and we all love it, and it harks back to a time. It's still good. It's still great. It's still.
You sound slightly less convinced, though, I must say, Francine.
Yeah, I'm a bit.
Is there any reason in particular? I mean, leafing through the issue you have there, is there a reason why? Is this a thing that's lost its way slightly, or an idea perhaps that has run its course somewhat?
Yeah, I mean, well, look at the cover. I mean, it's still got that lovely, iconic Rolling Stone logo, but it's now in an A4 glossy format, not that lovely newspaper, square newspaper that it used to have. I don't want to end on a bad note, really, but it's just, it's okay, but it's not wonderful. I think this is, you know, for anyone listening from Rolling Stone, wake it up, wake up, wake up. We've got to have a, you know, more controversial.
Let's end then on a positive note, because you were talking very eloquently about Gentlewoman, and it was interesting you mentioned these elements of the lineage, the history of magazines that run through. To bring it back sort of to where we began, looking at the ease with which publishers or editors can choose their demographics and appeal to them, what sort of advice would you give to somebody if they said, look, I've heard what you said about Gentlewoman, I think there's scope for me to do something else in that kind of marketplace as well. I'm interested in that over 50s audience. I'm aware of some of the key pitfalls to avoid and some of the key sort of strategic objectives I had broadly. Are there any shortcuts, I guess is the question I'm asking. Is there any shortcuts, or is it just about the old favourites of having that singular vision and sticking to it?
I think get some real people, you know, get a board of people who, you know, truly are, you know, more than just a focus group, get a group of really interesting, dynamic people who are in that age group and find out what they really want. Not look at marketing reports that say, you know, X percentage of people over 50 own a Volvo, or, you know, will buy this kind of camera, you know, and then gear the features towards that. Actually go for the soul of people. You know, what I really love about some of the new independent magazines that are coming out that aren't necessarily aimed at this age group, but are just wholesome magazines with soul. For instance, Hole and Corner, which is one of the very new ones, but it has lovely features about people making things and doing things. Things that it's not just what the people are buying, but what they aspire to. When you get to a certain age, you realise this is your last chance to learn to play the piano, learn to sing, paint, draw. So look at the things that people want to do, not what they are doing, their aspirations.
That is a positive note on which to end. Francine Lawrence, as always, thanks for joining us very much here on The Stack.
Thank you.
That brings us to the end of this 93rd edition of The Stack with me, Tom Edwards. Special thanks to my guest, Francine Lawrence, and to our producer, David Pleasant, and of course, our studio manager, Claire Urban. Tune in next week when we will be broadcasting live from Monocle's own summer fair right here at Midori House. Something of a nautical theme ahead. We'll be taking to the seas in search of the best of maritime-related print. Any comments or queries are welcome as always. Drop us a line at info@monocle.com. Join us again next Saturday then at the same time. Or you can always listen again if you're missing us at monocle.com or via iTunes. But for now, from me, Tom Edwards, that is all. Goodbye.